Welcome back, everyone, to the XCast. The truth is in here. I'm Tony Black, your host, and this week we're not covering an episode, we're covering a book again. And after we did the X-Files Origins Agent of Chaos last month, it's time to do the flip side. It's time to do Jonathan Mabry's Devil's Advocate. And I am really chuffed to be joined by a writer who has come on to talk about this book with me. So it's a real pleasure to invite on the show Lauren Furry. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, Tony. It's great to be here.
Well, it's really great to have you on the show, Lauren, because you, of course, like George Ivanov, who came on the show to talk Agents of Chaos, you too are part of the X-Files Secret Agendas anthology, aren't you? So, yeah, this is great to get another writer on who's connected to the X-Files.
I'm still shocked that I can be called a writer who's connected to the X-Files in any way, shape, or form.
It must feel really cool. We are going to talk about your short story, and I'm going to attempt to pronounce it right and most likely fail, even though we've talked about it before we recorded it. We're going to do that later, but yeah, it must be really cool to be involved now in the X-Files, to be part of it.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing like saying you have an actual childhood dream that has come true.
Yeah, totally. Before we talk about Devil's Advocate, though, we're going to just do the usual five questions of X with you, Lauren, in which we ask you about your X-Files fandom. You touched a little bit on this in your wonderful interview you did for the X-Cast blog a few months ago, which went into so much detail. It was a fantastic response. But yeah, we're going to go through this anyway and see how your fandom lies. So my first question is, when and how did you first discover the X-Files?
It's the easiest question. I remember it so clearly. I was 8 years old. It was right before the first season was about to start. And my dad, who I mentioned in that interview, he was an FBI special agent. He had been retired at the time, but he loved anything still with the FBI, of course. So he heard about this show coming on, and I remember exactly, he said to me, "Lauren, there's this new show on, and it's about FBI agents, so we have to watch it." And I was like, "Okay, Dad." And we watched it from, like, that first episode, and we never missed an episode together, the whole original 9 seasons. Even, like, when we were going to be out, and this was pre-DVR, like, we would tape it on the VHS and then watch it together, you know, if we missed a Friday or a Sunday night. So, yeah, it's been a part of my life, really, since it first came on. I even wrote to Gillian Anderson for an elementary school project where we had to write to our heroes. Like, people were writing, you know, to, like, political figures or, like, the Queen of England, and I was like, "Gillian Anderson." They're like, "Who is that?" I'm like, "It's Agent Scully. What's wrong with you people?"
Cause, yeah, it's Scully.
I was like, nobody else's parents apparently allowed them to watch The X-Files. So,
Well, you were winning. You were winning there, definitely. And you had your own personal Mulder. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, my dad had his actual FBI badge, and when he retired, it got mounted. But, like, we have just paper files, like, he would bring home, and that we would, nothing in them, but, like, just to say the, you know, FBI on it. And I remember there was a time my dad contacted some of his friends who were still working at the FBI to see if he could get me one of those FBI windbreakers that they were always wearing in the show. but unfortunately, they were like, no, that's, you know, it's a uniform, so we can't just give those out.
Well, you had to try. You had to try.
Yeah,
you had to see.
He did try. I always appreciated that he tried.
That's an awesome backstory, though, for discovering the X-Files. That's really, really good and really different from anyone else's who's come on the show so far. So that's awesome. That's awesome. Let's see if you've got a different answer to this one, though, because my next question is, what is your favorite episode of the X-Files? Now, we've had a varied amount here, so it'd be interesting to see if you come up with one that other people have already.
This is very difficult, and I had narrowed it down to 4. But I think I'm going to ultimately have to go with the one I even had, like, the novelization version of, and that's Darkness Falls.
Ah, yeah. I had a feeling you were going to say that. That's a good one. Why would you go with that one?
I've been trying to think that, and it has something to go with. First, I always love the classic monster episodes the best. All of those top is my favorites. And there's something about this one that's very much just like that typical cabin in the woods horror story that you don't know what it is, and you have to stay in the light, you know, and stay out of the darkness, and you don't know what was going to happen to Mulder and Scully, that it just really stuck with me. And I would think almost every other classic episode, when I would watch them, I would try to, like, compare it back to Darkness Falls. I'm like, was it as good as this one? Did it have as much suspense in it, you know, much life or death and creepy things? And that plus the image of the body and the giant cocoon. I live in the woods, and so we had the smaller cocoons like that. And I remember thinking after that episode, like, walking around the woods around my house trying to see if I could, like, find one just like Mulder and Scully had. And fortunately, I never have, but it's always been in my mind.
Well, there's still time, Lauren. Not to scare you. But I would never walk out in the woods again, I think. I'd just stay in my house forever or build a tunnel. Cool. Would you say then, my next question is, what is your favorite season? Would you say season one, where Darkness Falls Lies, is your favorite season, or do you have another one?
No, it's season one. That's what I put down. I mean, I actually went back and I looked through all my DVDs and I was like, how can I narrow it down? Which one's the best? And it really does come back to season one. Because for me, it's something you get a lot of the classic episodes. And also, it was before, like, you know, the mythology started to get a little too convoluted and they can contradict each other. It's kind of still setting everything up in a really nice way. I think it goes back to season one for me.
Yeah, a couple of people have said that lately, actually, season one. I think it's getting a little bit more of a resurgence amongst X-Files fans. You know, most people tend to say seasons three, seasons four, five, or whatever. But yeah, I think a lot more people are going back and seeing the early episodes and thinking, you know what, there's some good stuff in there.
It's a bit dated. I mean, you watch like the phones and the clothes and the hair and you think, oh, the 90s and the suits and the production values, but then you look at it, the stories themselves just still really stand out strongly.
Yeah, they do. They are so 90s though, the fashions, aren't they? That's what really struck me.
I always wanted a flip phone. I was so disappointed that I never got a flip phone like Mulder. They got rid of them totally, so it's...
They did, and then we had the Matrix phones for a while. The Neo phone from the Matrix, where it would just slide out when you press a button, like that.
I think it was either, man.
But yeah, it's season one. Season one's a good choice, definitely. So who would you say your favourite character is then? That's my next question. Now, it doesn't have to just be Mulder and Scully. It could be anybody. Who would you put at the top?
One of the bad guys. And I put down, I was thinking, if I had to pick up like my favourite, especially out of the bad guys, go for Toombs. Because his episodes, like, there's just something about his face. And, you know, the way he looked, and he was so calm, and, you know, just the fact that he could fool everyone, and his death with the escalator. Of course,
yeah.
I look at escalators, and, like, I still imagine, like, him getting trapped under there, and, like, the blood that comes when it circles around, but there's... Yeah, he was just such a calm villain, and that's what, I think, got under Mulder's skin a lot, too, because they knew... You know, he was dangerous and they couldn't prove it.
It was that silence, wasn't it? You know, the fact he didn't have to say anything, really. He could just stare with those big bug eyes and just creep you out that way.
He pops up in some other shows, that same actor, I can't remember his name. I'm like, Toombs! And like, actually playing a good guy or something. I'm like, no, it's just a trick.
Yeah, he was Doug Hutchinson. Yeah, he was in Lost at one point. And I remember watching Lost and going, and he was playing like a hippie, like, hey man, how you doing? And like, I was like, no, just run away from him. He's going to eat your liver. What are you talking? So yeah, a good choice. Good choice with Toombs. Good choice. And not everyone chooses a villain usually when I ask that question. So that's nice. That's nice. Finally then, for the five questions, what would you say your favorite moment from the entire show is? From any episode, any season, have you got a special particular moment?
This one I thought of pretty quickly, and that was going to Bad Blood. Which is probably second favorite episode. It was really close. There's so many great moments in that, but one that always stood out to me is when Scully's doing like one of the autopsies, and it's like the second or third one, and she's just throwing the organs on the scale. And like, she just doesn't care anymore. And like I just remember like the small intestine that's on there, and then it just like starts to fall off.
Yeah, it takes ages to fall off, doesn't it? And her face is just like...
And there's just the humor of that moment, and like taking something that was supposed to, you know, usually so disgusting, and just being able to laugh at it and the silliness of everything. I just love that moment.
That whole episode is just gold. It's just gold. And to think that was Vince Gilligan, you know, who then went on to write like Breaking Bad. It's just crazy, really. It's just crazy. It's such a great episode. So yeah, good choices. Good choices for the five questions of X. So yeah, we've got a nice little gauge of your fandom there, Lauren. So yeah, shall we move on and talk about the matter at hand, which is, of course, Jonathan Maybury's Devil's Advocate. The X-Files Origins Devil's Advocate was published in January 2017. And is written by Jonathan Maybury. It is part of a collection with the X-Files Origins Agent of Chaos, which was written by Cammy Garcia, which, as I mentioned before, we talked about on the show about a month ago. And this book is the flip side to the young Fox Mulder story, in which he's set in 1979 and saw him on his first track to becoming the FBI agent we know and love. In this book, it's the story of young Scully, who is 15 years old, living in the small town of Crager in Maryland, where she's moved with her family after Father William Scully is transferred from San Diego. And she soon finds herself in a completely new town, completely new friends around her, and a pretty creepy and terrifying mystery about dead teenagers and spooky, angelic or devilish visions. So, Lauren, out of 10, and I do a number rating on every episode, so it only seems fitting that we do it on the books. Out of 10, what would you give Devil's Advocate?
Yeah, I would say 7.5.
Why would you give it that?
One, I really liked how Jonathan got into, like, a teenage Dana Scully's head. Because it feels like the Scully we know, but previous, like, without the experience that she has coming into the X-Files or the experiences that happened to her after, you can really see this 15-year-old girl developing into her. And I think that's something that's really hard to do, and he did it so well. And with that, too, I really like how he alternates the chapters between the moments with Scully and with, I guess, called the bad guys on the plot that's happening with these murders to kind of give the two perspectives, just like an episode. So that kept me really intrigued, because he does it in a really nice way where you're learning more than Scully and her friends, but you still don't know exactly what's going on. And at the same time, it is aimed at the YA audience. So I think I figured it out a little sooner than maybe I would have liked to figure out the ending. But I think it's a really, really good for the YA audience. And I was telling some of my online creative writing students about it. And I said, if I had been a teenage girl when this was written, I would have eaten this book up in like 2 seconds. It took me like 3 seconds this time. But back then, this would have been like on my shelf day one it came out.
You know, you're absolutely right when you say how he writes a teenage Scully really, really well. That really struck me. I mean, that's, you know, Jonathan's been on the show to talk, and he's a guy, and he's, you know, with the greatest respect to Jonathan, he's not a young guy. And the fact he can get into the mind of a teenage girl in such a really interesting way and really capture, I think, Scully as a young girl, I was really impressed by that. And I think that the more the story developed and the more he got into the book, the more we started to get into Scully's mind in a really interesting way. And even though she's 15, she still felt like Scully. Mm-hmm. And that's the biggest thing that struck me, and I was really, really impressed by.
Yeah, you can really see his experience. You know, he has tons of YA books out there, and why he's so good at it and so successful. And I think he's just was able to translate that now to these other characters, these pre-existing characters.
I like the story as well. It was funny because when we did Agent of Chaos, I hadn't read Devil's Advocate at that point, and George Ivanoff, when he came on, he said that, without giving too much away, he said at the time that it's interesting how the supernatural story of the two was given to Scully and it wasn't given to Mulder. And, you know, in Agent of Chaos, Mulder's story is much more along the procedural axis, you know, and he starts to uncover murders and he gets more into that will lead him into the violent crimes that he is involved in before the X-Files. Whereas with Scully, this is something really very Mulder-like in terms of, you know, links to conspiracy, ghosts, you know, devils and everything like that. So it is interesting how well, actually, this kind of story works for Scully.
I think that was a really smart part on the decision to put these books out there to give Mulder a more Scully-like story and Scully a more Mulder-like story. Because I think it could have been really easy to fall into, you know, a pretty straightforward, oh yeah, it's Mulder and it's another X-Files where he wants to believe in the supernatural. But to twist it and give it to Scully allows her to explore that side of herself that she always says that she wants to believe, like Mulder does. Like, I think, what was it, the tagline they were always advertising it as was the story of how she became a skeptic.
Yeah.
And I think this story works really well. I mean, such a traumatic experience for her. It does set up well with the adult Scully that we know and why she is going to be so hesitant to believe in anything that supernatural again, because she's been so badly burned in the past.
Yeah, and I wondered when I was reading it first, I was thinking to myself, where is this really going in that direction? I was wondering, you know, and I think he does a really good job of leading you to a point where you think that Scully is actually experiencing things that are maybe a bit too supernatural for the context of the Scully we later know. But then by the end of the book, you realise that that's the whole point, in that she's, you know, the sequence where she goes out of her body and she travels up through the Earth into space and she sees an alien spacecraft on the moon. It's one of those things. As I was reading it, I was going, what? Is this really happening to Scully? But then that is the point, that that's one of those things that she completely would shut down later in life. And she would say, well, that didn't happen. That's just drugs. Or that was just, you know, X, Y, and Z. Of course I didn't do that. So I love the fact that the story had the guts to actually put Scully in that really sort of undeniably supernatural or paranormal, you know, experience at such a young age.
With that, it tied in with the relationship with her sister really well, because Melissa is somebody who does stay more of, you know, on the side of believing in these types of things. And you would think that, oh, maybe she'll believe her sister, she'll believe Dana, that she went through this, and, you know, not believe supernatural as much. But for Melissa, it kind of more cemented her that, no, you know, I was right. I don't want to be wrong about this. I don't want to have been lied to, which I think It gives a little bit more backstory to their relationship when we see Melissa as an adult on the show.
Yeah, it does. It makes you understand, you know, to a degree where, like you say, where how Melissa's got to that point, where she's coming from, and the difference between her and Dana. And I think that be not just in age and the way they approach things, and that Melissa's a lot more, you know, relaxed in many respects. You know, all through this story, she has this undercurrent of having a boyfriend called Dave, or like a secret boyfriend called Dave, if she's, you know, sloping off with going to his house, whereas Dana finds it painfully. And importantly, she's referred to as Dana through most of the book. You know, she's only Scully when she's referred to as her full name. She's Dana. So this is before Scully, as Mulder would call her. So yeah, I should start calling her Dana, really, like the book. But Dana is painfully awkward around Ethan and, to a degree, Angelo. And so it's a big contrast between her and Melissa, which really comes out in the book, which I thought was very good. So yeah, it's got lots of different things going on. I think I'd give it around the same. I might even give it an 8. I got to say, I got really into it. I got really invested in the story, invested in the character, invested in all the different people around her. Yeah, I really got into this. I really enjoyed it. I was surprised at the choices of, you mentioned earlier, the chapters separating when it was Dana and when it wasn't. But the chapters were so short. That was something that really hit me. I've rarely seen that before.
There's something I read not too long ago that also had short chapters. I can't for the life of me remember what it was. But I think it worked really well. It almost felt like watching an episode more. Because sometimes you have very short scenes where they would just show, you know, a hint of what the monster's up to, or a hint of, you know, what's going on with them, with these men in black, or somebody on the other side. So I think with the small interspersed scenes, that mainly worked really well for me to, like, give me that glimpse to the other side, but then wanting to get back to what was happening with Scully and seeing how the two would overlap.
Yeah, and I think it's to do with pacing. I think you're right. I think the pacing element with having the shorter chapters does help, definitely. And I think that must have been a conscious choice. And it's an interesting conscious choice. And I'll be honest, it took me a little bit of time to get used to that. And to get used to not, you know, there are a few longer chapters, like the sequence, as I mentioned, where Scully has Dana has the moment where she comes out of her body. That's a longer chapter, but a lot of them are very short. Once I got into that, it did help the pace. It's a different tempo, really, almost certainly to the other book, which I really appreciated and I liked in terms of the story. So yeah, I think there's a lot to unpick here. There's a lot to unpick. Let's start then with Dana. Let's start with her as a character, because obviously at this point she's 15. She's just moved to a new town. Her brother Bill isn't around, but Melissa's there. Her little brother Charlie, who's crazy by the look of it, just running around in his own fantasy world. And then her mom, Margaret, and dad, William. And she's at an interesting point, isn't she? She's kind of a little bit, she seems a bit lost in many respects to me throughout a lot of this.
15 is such a weird age to begin with. You know, you're like an older teenager, but you're not you know, close to 18 yet, being an adult. And I think on top of that, they did have her just move, not only like move a little bit, but move totally across the country from the West Coast in San Diego all the way over to the East Coast in Maryland. I never had to move that way, but I had friends that did. And when you move in high school, it's tough. I mean, it's really hard to make new friends and to fit in with a group. And for somebody, I think, like Dana here, who is really smart, but also like really shy and reserved about things at times and unsure of herself, it makes it very difficult to, you know, be comfortable. And I think that was a nice backdrop to have towards, not only is she uncomfortable in general about life, but uncomfortable because people are getting murdered and she's having these really weird visions. So it's like, yeah, takes that element of being, you know, an awkward, uncomfortable teenager in a new place and just compounds that and makes it even worse for her.
It's a classic kind of trope you find in like a lot of, you know, horror movies. And I know Jonathan is a big guy for a big horror guy, a big horror fiction guy, and as well as you know doing a lot of young adult stuff. That's his bread and butter, really. And it has that kind of the young girl having visions, having these, you know, seeing these ghostly apparitions, and you know, all these horrible, you know, quite vicious murders going on. There is a real sort of horror undercurrent to this whole story that comes through the kind of things Dana's seeing, which you know you wouldn't necessarily have expected. And I think it's really good in allowing us to get into her mind and get into how she just finds everything so difficult. And that's something that comes through so much. She just finds, compared to the Scully that we know later, you know, who's got all these skills and she's, you know, very contained and you know, able to be very professional, this is really, really comes off really well, that Dana is just really trying to find herself all the way through, which is natural, isn't it, for a teenager and in this kind of story.
I mean, there's times like he wrote her so well that I forgot it was like the young Dana Scully, because they're talking about the chemical that they find in the teen's bloodstream and stuff, and she's asking like these questions about the human body. I'm like, but you should know. I'm like, you're Scully. And then I'm like, wait, no, she's 15. She hasn't even graduated high school, let alone gone med school. She doesn't know these things. But it's interesting because that all those sparks are there. Like, she, everything's difficult, but she keeps fighting through it. Like, she still wants to get to the answer. And she uses the skills that she does have to try to get the answer that she can, which I think resonates with her character when she gets older. She just, like you said, she develops the skills to solve some of those problems more on her own.
Yeah, and seeing those sparks, as you call them, you're absolutely right. Seeing those sparks was great because, you know, you're watching the little opening things in her head that she's thinking, oh yeah, I like this. And the same happened with Mulder, you know, in Agents of Chaos, in that he's you know, investigating, you know, these dark crimes, and he's starting to, you know, put things together and take these leaps of logic, and you can see the formation. In this case, it's the same with Dana here. You can see the formation of the things she would go on and study and go on and be interested in. It is really good to see, as surrounded by all of the teenage angst she feels in so many ways, you know, with her family, with the boys that she quite likes or quite like her, with, you know, even, you know, her schoolwork and her doing her jujitsu and all these combat. And then, of course, you know, the visions and all the stuff that's happening to her. There's lots and lots swirling around, and you just really do feel that all the way through. And, you know, as a connection to the show as well, I thought this quite nicely links into the episode Elegy. I don't know if you remember that one in season 4, where she sees a dead woman. She sees a dead girl. It's when she's dying of cancer and she's getting the nosebleeds and she's still at work and she's saying, I need to. It's the very end of season 4 before she goes into hospital and things like that. But there's this episode where there's lots of people dying, and there's an autistic guy who's obsessed with the names and everything like that. And she sees a dead girl and she has to go to a counsellor because she thinks she's losing her mind. But it made me think of Elegy, you know, this. It's and there is no direct connection, but it's little, almost like little winks to the show that I appreciate, really. And there were quite, did you notice any other winks to the actual episodes, Lauren, in this?
What I kept thinking of was the Moby Dick. Yeah. Because I miss Queequeg a lot. When Queequeg gets eaten, I mean, I'm a big dog person, and that was rough for me. That was probably one of the worst moments in the X-Files for me, knowing that Queequeg got eaten by a sea monster and he's not coming back. But that, when she saw everything with her father, that reminded me a lot, because I remember the difficulties with her father on her show and her father calling her Starbuck in the show. I was like, so this is more of like where that comes from and why that's so important to her, because the book goes into a lot of really how difficult her father is and, you know, how reserved he is. And he's very much, you know, the Navy guy and giving orders. But when they read Moby Dick together, it's this one unique thing that she can share with him that her siblings can't. And it's really the main thing that they bond over. So that I really like that feeling, more of that backstory filled in with her and her family.
Did you not find, though, at various points, especially towards the end, this is something that struck me. Did you not find that William Scully was painted quite severely in the sense of that Margaret seems very terrified by him and quite cowed, which doesn't, I don't know if that really tracks with the Margaret Scully we know when she's older, although that could just be an age thing. But he's got a very imposing sort of almost, I'd hesitate to use the word bully, but a real presence like that I don't know. I mean, maybe it could well be quite accurate, really, in that the show, because obviously we don't see him very much in the show. He dies pretty much as soon as we meet him in the TV show. But yeah, I don't know. Do you think that fitted William very well?
One thing that struck me, especially at that scene at the end, towards the end, where they think like Scully, they test her blood and they find the drug in it, that you have this daughter who's like the perfect daughter, pretty much, who always tells you the truth, who's not prone to lying. And you don't believe her, or you don't even try to see her side of the story. That's what struck me about like how harsh he was. But at the same time, I mean, my dad was FBI, but he wasn't like that. He wasn't, you know, that stringent of military. I mean, he let me watch The X-Files at 8, so. But I have other friends who have military parents, and they said, you know, growing up, their house was run more like a military household. And it wasn't until they were older that their mother or their father was able to relax a little bit more. So it did strike me as a little bit too severe. And then I could still justify a bit saying, well, the guy on the show, this is like decades later. So maybe by this point and his other, whatever experiences they've had as a family have mellowed him out a bit since then.
Yeah, that's what I wondered afterwards. I thought, am I being a bit too, am I wrong about this? Would it fit? And I guess it does in a way. He would have been harder. And, you know, there are hints in this book and that connect to the... Because one of the things that Jonathan mentioned when he came on the show to talk about this was that these books are in canon with the X-Files Origins comic, which came out last summer by Matthew Dowsmith. And there's a sequel coming out in a couple of months, which Matthew will be coming back on the show to talk about that. But they are linked, and there is a fleeting connection to events that happen to Scully when she's more around the age of 12, 13 years old in those comics. And the suggestion, and those comics, there's William Scully is involved in nefarious activities. And there are not as a bad guy, but kind of in the sense that he's kind of being forced into something. And that there was a big suggestion in this book, certainly at the end, that William may well be involved in the conspiracy or linked to the conspiracy somehow, and maybe that accounts for why he's very harsh. In a similar way to sort of like Mulder's dad is in Agent of Chaos. There's similarities between the two, actually, which hadn't really occurred to me before this.
Yeah, so that connection to the comics makes more sense, and I haven't read them, but I felt like, sometimes I felt like I was missing something. I'm like, is William Scully more involved in this book and what's going on in this mystery that I'm aware of? Because they mention him at times and how he owes them. And I was like, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
It's something I just didn't pick up on the first read, but that makes sense if it's something from the comic. But yeah, if he is hiding something, I could see him like overreacting.
It's not been fully, as far as I remember, it's not been fully revealed in the comic yet. I think it's a continuing kind of story, but there are hints as to what we've already seen, and I think what we will see in the comic as well. And it's there if... I don't think it intrudes on the story necessarily and it makes you, you know, it takes you out of the story necessarily, but it's there. It's extra, like, deep dive stuff if you want to, you know, find it. But it could factor in. And we talked a little bit earlier about Melissa as being quite a, you know, a good younger representation of the Melissa we see, albeit briefly, in the TV show. But I like their dynamic. I like Dana and Melissa's dynamic because they're very clearly different people and they're well written in that sense.
They are. They really felt like sisters too. I mean, there's people that they're closer in age than their brothers, and so you could see that closeness with them despite the big differences that they have. Just them in the beginning when they go to the cafe Beyond and just kind of have tea together and drink and talk. It's like, oh, it feels like a sister relationship. And that's what I think made the ending so nice. Well, not nice for them, but to show where they went from this closeness to creating this division that's going to last with them. Because it hurt, because you had seen their relationship before that, and now they're going to let their differences kind of demolish some of that bond. But yeah, it was nice to see the way he tackled the siblings like that, because, you know, I have two older sisters, and despite, you know, being raised in the same environment in the same way, you do develop such differences between you that I think some people can't capture in writing that I thought Jonathan did really well.
Yeah, I agree. And obviously I'm not a woman, but I've never had a sister either. So I don't know how those extra things that you would get out of it, but yeah, it did strike me as really well put together. And like you said, you know, they in the show, much as Melissa's death really, really impacts Scully forever, really, throughout the entire show, when she's eventually murdered, they're not necessarily very close. And you, in the limited time we see them together, you do get that sense that they're not always together, and that there is that sort of, if not ideological, then personal difference between how they see the world, which is, even though we only see Melissa once or twice in the show, she's well characterized in that sense. So yeah, it's a good lead in for that. You're absolutely right with Melissa there. Around the Scully family, there are also some, I think, really quite well drawn characters. You have the two men in Scully's life in many respects. Firstly, Ethan Hale, who is a boy in the high school. He's sort of a bit like Mulder.
That's
in a way.
Yeah, I kept
isn't he?
Myself, it wasn't young Mulder, you know. It was this separate character that, you know, does not grow up to be the FBI agent partner with her. He's just a guy in high school, because yeah, he shares a lot of the same characteristics of wanting to, you know, be a detective and solve these cases, solve these murders, but also wanting to protect her at the same time. But yeah, there were several points when I went where, like, reading it almost as like Fox Mulder, I'm like, nope, Ethan.
Yeah. He has that level of detachment from everybody else as well, doesn't he, Ethan? He's not normal, in inverted commas. Everyone else sort of doesn't quite associate with him in the same way. He's quite driven. He sort of takes Scully along for the ride. He's also quite charming and funny to her in a way, but he frustrates her at times. I thought what I really liked about the writing in this was how certain real situations existed. Like the moment where Ethan's trying to protect her and he says, "But you're a girl." Mm-hmm. And she says, what was that? What were you about to say? And he said, I didn't mean it. And she just says, yes, you did. And then walks off. I thought that was great, because that's exactly what you people would react like, isn't it?
I mean, as a girl too, I've been told that. And it's like, what does that mean? You know, my parents raised us, there's no difference. We're all girls. And my dad never said we couldn't do anything because we were girls. So what the heck are you talking about? So I found that moment very relatable.
And someone like yourself, and certainly like Dana, would react to that as if to say, who do you think you're talking to? Who do you think you are? You know, just because I'm a girl doesn't mean I'm any less capable of doing this than you are. And it's a great little moment. You know, it was just a very real moment, in that later on, you know, he's not a jerk. He makes a mistake. He knows he's made a mistake, and by the end, you know, he tells her, "I'm sorry. You know, I was a fool." But yeah, he was a good character. I liked their dynamic. I liked how it built into a blossoming romance quite sweetly and awkwardly, and well, really awkwardly at times.
They even had, like, their own little lone gunman, too.
They did. The little science club.
Science labs, yeah, and they're like the science squad. I'm like, I could read more about the science squad here.
Well, I did think, I don't know about you, I did wish they'd been in it a bit more, actually.
They were, like, they show up so briefly, but yeah. It describes them so well, and they come off the page. I'm like, let's talk to them more. I mean, these kids are smart. They're like the Scooby-Doo gang.
Well, I know that when we spoke to Jonathan, he did say he's got like about 10 books out of this sequel-wise. He could write these forever. So I think if these have sold well and they continue to sell well, we might well see more of that gang, hopefully. They might be sequel potential. Well, fingers crossed there. But they were really good. They were really well drawn. What about a relationship with Angelo, who is an interesting character? He's the Latino guy working at Beyond Beyond, which is the alternative, you know, psychic kind of shop that is very crucial to the story. He's interesting, isn't he, as a character, because he's you don't always get the beat on him, do you, as exactly who he is?
No, I mean, sometimes he feels just like an outcast that nobody talks to, and maybe if you just talked to them, he'd warm up. But then other times, he's quite overtly aggressive.
Yeah.
He carries a switchblade. So that kind of negates some of the sweetness that possibly he could have. But yeah, I think he comes across really as this torn character who's been beat down a lot by life, and who on one side is trying to make the best out of his situation by working all these jobs, trying to, you know, become a mechanic or open a shop. And on the other side, he's very aggressive and can be very manipulating about it too, to get what he wants, which I think played into the plot well when they, you know, they try to kind of set him up to be the murderer.
Yeah, which I don't think any of us bought that, did we? Like you said earlier.
I don't know if we were meant to buy it either. I think it was more of those things where it's meant for the characters to believe in. You know, no, it's not true. But it's like, yeah, they have somebody to blame so they can stop looking, even though in your head you're shouting, no, but it's really not him. Keep looking.
Yeah, it's not that guy. He's sort of feelings towards Dana, because he clearly has feelings. You know, there is, it's either a protectiveness or an attraction in some way. And she responds, you know, there is an element of Scully that he's drawn to him as well, I think, as well as Ethan. So it's not quite a love triangle, but it's an interesting little connection really there that is different from what she has with Ethan.
Yeah, it like plays into that almost the theme of angels and demons in the book. I don't know. This might be reading too much into it, because Ethan really is the good guy and the sweet guy.
Yeah.
The kid that's her age and you know, does science with her. And then Angelo is kind of like the brooding, tough guy that's possibly super violent or bad. And she's kind of is torn between them a little bit.
And of course, Angelo is being in many ways manipulated and, you know, by the characters in Beyond Beyond, of Corinda, Howell, and Sunlight. Now, Corinda is actually interesting, because she is the connective point between both books, as in Corinda appears in Agent of Chaos as well. Because I don't know if you know this, Lauren, but Mulder goes to that shop days before Scully goes there. Young Mulder is in that shop on, I think this story sort of takes place in the first week of March. Mulder is in that shop on like first week of April, sorry. Mulder is in that shop like the last day of March, and he goes there to get some information and a completely separate storyline, completely separate plot. But he ends up in Beyond Beyond in Krager at exactly the same time Scully is hanging around that shop. So they would have almost met each other. They may well have passed each other at various points. And Corinda is briefly involved in that story. Not nearly to the same degree she is in Devil's Advocate. So there is a connective point between the two books, which comes through Beyond Beyond, which is quite cool, I think, if you've read both of them.
She was an interesting character in this one. She's somebody that comes across as very nice, and you want to believe what she's saying. You want to believe that she has these psychic powers. But at the same time, you're really suspicious, because who has psychic powers like that? You know, even in the world of the X-Files, and you're kind of wondering what her game is, and can she do this? Does she really want to help? But, you know, she's trying to manipulate at the same time. So you don't really know where to put her, really, until the end.
There is a level of ambiguity all the way through the book. By the end, it's kind of confirmed, isn't it, really, that she's a fake in many respects. But the ambiguity is good, and the way she... I think she genuinely does care for Dana. I think there is genuinely an affection there. And she sees something in the girl. Like, you know, there's that passage where she talks about how she was the freak. She was the isolated one at school. She was the one who was picked on. And I think there was a lot... I think that was all true. I think that she sees a kinship in Scully, in Dana. And that's why she does try and help her in a sense. But she is doing it for her own personal reasons as well. But I did believe that. I did believe that she does actually care for Dana.
It's one of those things, it's hard, you care for somebody, but you're playing this, like, game of manipulation so long with the world that you can't come clean to them because she knows that what it'll do, how it'll break that bond that she created with her.
Again, another well-drawn character, as was Sunlight, who, of course, is...
Never trust a guy named Sunlight. Any guy with sun in his name.
Yes. It's always a suspicious name, especially when he's the opposite. Spoilers. I suppose you can see this coming, but that's not the point. It's not the point that you pretty much can guess that Sunlight is probably the angel or the devil or whatever he is. But he's interesting because there's some backstory to the angel that we don't quite get, to the devil. Never know quite know what to call him. But yeah, there's some backstory in that there's a few references to the... I don't know if you picked up on this, Lauren, but there's a few references to something called the Montauk Project.
Yeah, throughout. I saw that in there.
Now, are you familiar with the Montauk Project at all?
No, I am not.
Now, the Montauk Project is a real thing in real life conspiracy theory. It was an alleged secret of a series of secret government projects conducted at Camp Hero or Montauk Air Force Station on Long Island for the purpose of developing psychological warfare techniques and so-called exotic research, including time travel. A lot of people consider it to be sort of an outgrowth of the Philadelphia experiment, which was the famous 1940s experiment, which apparently made a submarine invisible, which comes back in the episode .com, where they end up in Norway aging rapidly. I don't even remember that one. But yeah, it's apparently linked to UFOs. It's linked to that kind of stuff, and obviously this all goes back to the Syndicate, and we'll talk more about that in a bit. But there's interesting backstory we don't quite get about that links to real life lore, which I thought was quite good. So there's a lot about Sunlight we don't know as a character.
Yes, I kind of wanted more about him. Like now, once we realize the connection, what is his end game? Where did he get these powers from? Why is he allowed to like be running a cafe?
Yeah, it's true.
I think that would be something the government even would want to keep like a tight rein on. But then I find that that's true of a lot of the X-Files stories. We don't get the backstory. We get, you know, the monster. We get what's happening right now, and we don't find out really how we got to that point to begin with. And we don't find out much about what happened after. Usually a lot of the stories, a lot of the episodes end on those cliffhangers that never get resolved. Like Tombs, his episodes are one of the few where it does continue a cliffhanger storyline and we do get some resolution to it. So I think the book did echo that formula of the series well, even as I wanted to know more about him and what he was up to and what he was going to do next.
Well, I mean, we might get that. You know, if we do get a sequel, if Sunlight isn't dead by the end, there is a possibility we might see him again and we might get more about this, because there's a difference, I think, between who he is or what he is compared to what he believes. You know, he believes he's an angel. He believes that in all this myth, all the real, again, the real life mythology of the Grigori and the Nephilim, who the Grigori were the like an ancient race of angels, or could be aliens. I mean, this is the thing. Given it's the X-Files and there's not much that separates God in the X-Files and aliens as the series goes on, it could be both. He talks about that, and the Nephilim were the race of creatures who were created when angels interbred with mankind. And he's talking about bringing all those back through like a painting, like a portal he's creating and things like that. Now, whether or not that's true, because the reasons why the Syndicate are controlling him is that they're looking for a weapon. You know, they're looking to develop weapon technology to fight the future, quite literally. So there's some interesting backstory there with him that I don't know if it because the whole idea of the story for Dana and the visions ties into the religious aspect, which isn't fully hit too head on in this story, really, compared to when she has a lot of struggles with her faith in the show. And there's some things with angels and demons and devils and things that conflict with Scully. There's not a lot about religion in this for her, is there?
I mean, the show, she did struggle, like you said, a lot more with her beliefs related to God specifically. And that this book is more just kind of her struggles with the supernatural and not so much her struggle with her belief in God, which I think makes sense. As a teenager, you can only struggle with so much at one time.
Yeah.
I think,
yeah.
it does set up, though, well for her questioning things in the future, because if she questions the supernatural now and the fact that, is she having visions, you know, did she have an out-of-body experience, is there a real angel, and she realizes, nope, that's not true, that does set up a building block for questioning the foundations of her religion later.
Yeah, there is a tether. There is a definite tether. And, you know, it's all, like the blurb says, it's all about Scully coming to not believe because she's, you know, too afraid in many respects, or she goes a different path. She goes into the path of science. And that this is all about the formation of that. So the religious aspect is something that could well come up later. And it's more specific in that comic prequel, actually, because it's about the murder of a priest, a family priest who she grew up knowing when she's 12 on this San Diego base. So there's more to do with the religious aspect in the Origins comic than this story, which is interesting. And given that the visions are very based around angels and demons and devils, the fact that Sunlight's backstory isn't necessarily that he is an angel, that he is a man who, for whatever reason, has been manipulated, is interesting. And like you say, you don't get it all. We don't get all the backstory. And I do like that. I do like the fact we only have hints. But obviously the syndicate lurking about is something, I don't know about you, I think this could concern a few fans in that the syndicate were interested in Dana this young.
Yeah, it almost sets it up like, oh, it's like predestined that she's going to go into the X-Files and she's going to meet Mulder. And that, I don't think she was. I mean, I think it for me, I was just like that they kind of found each other in that play, in the FBI at the same time. And we're at the X-Files at the same time. But to make it so that, like, they were targeting her this young, almost, I don't know, gives them too far a reach into her life and just, like, the story mythology.
Yeah, a little bit. It's not, thankfully, it's not too overt, really. And it's not to the point where there's a moment in Agent of Chaos that I had a little bit of trouble with, which is where Mulder directly hears the word cigarette smoking man. I had real trouble with that because I just don't think that would have happened. But there's nothing in here. Scully never has any idea that these people are watching her. There's no... Sunlight says a few things about the real forces controlling me and blah, blah, blah at the end, but it's nothing specific for Scully. So there's no moment where she faces, say, like the smoking man and he does a little bit of a smoke dragon and goes, Scully! Thankfully, there's nothing like that. So they can kind of get away with it. It's more in the background.
It reminds me of what Noah Hawley said about Fargo. Like, people are wondering with each season, why is he going to new characters, like, for each season? And he said something along the lines of, well, it's kind of improbable that these people would have that many, like, horrific events happen to them in the course of their one life. It wouldn't be believable to go through that many massacres. So they had to change the characters. And that's what I kind of got with trying to draw that connection to Scully. I'm like, is it really believable that this much would be happening to her as a child, as a teenager, on top of everything that's going to happen to her, you know, as an adult?
Yeah. You do have to suspend a little bit of belief with that. But the thing is, that's one of the things that there has been a little bit of, among some fan circles, there has been some difficulty with these prequels in the sense that they're kind of telling stories that didn't necessarily happen, or certainly one in the mind of Chris Carter, you know, back in the day, but they wouldn't have been. I mean, this is the whole thing about an expanded mythology and an expanded universe. And this is, you know, we live in a world now where everything is expanding, universes are expanding, backstories are happening, movies like Rogue One are filling in a story in Star Wars that nobody knew existed. But that's part of the fun. I think that's part of the fun. And I think, yeah, okay, it may not necessarily be something that the show would have done, but that doesn't mean it's not valid. And I think a story like this, in how it's told, I think it fits. I think especially Devil's Advocate, in some respects, I think Devil's Advocate fits a little bit better than Agents of Chaos, actually. It fits Scully as a young woman, I think.
Yeah, I mean, there's something with expanded universes. You can either do it really well, like in Star Wars, like Rogue One. I happen to be wearing a Rogue One t-shirt right now.
Never.
But then you can also do it really poorly, like Phantom Menace. And I think you're right. I really enjoyed having this insight into her life because I got to learn more about, like, one of my favorite characters, and not only just like reading a biography of her, but it's an actual thing, something that happened to her that I could believe happened to her, that, you know, set her up for what was going to happen to her later in life, and just gave me more X-Files in a good way, which who doesn't want that?
Exactly. And I think for fans, there are lots of little things that you can pick out and enjoy. Some of the winks, like the fact that we see the First Elder, who was one of the original Syndicate guys. He was the heavyset guy who spoke a little bit like Marlon Brando in The Godfather, if you remember him. So he's like, has the project been completed? That kind of thing, you know. he turns up at one point, giving some orders to Agent Gerlach. I don't quite know how you say his name. He's the red-haired agent.
My family is German background, so we would say Lack with a CK, but if he's not German, maybe it's Lack.
Well, his first name's Malcolm, so...
Let's go with Malcolm.
Who knows? Gerlach. We'll go with Gerlach. Gerlach. But he puts the fear of God up everybody. He is, as far as I'm aware, he isn't a character from the show. Because in Agent of Chaos, we see X. We see a young Mr. X, and he plays a part in the sort of background of Mulder with the Smoking Man more overtly. And we do briefly see the Smoking Man at the very end. But it's... Gerlach, I don't think, is in the show. So he's a new creation. But he was quite a creepy character, wasn't he, really? Controlling the puppet strings.
I enjoyed reading his scenes a lot. I go for the bad guys. But it was a nice type of villainy in the sense that he wasn't... Yeah, he was. I like how they explain why they wear the suits and being called the Men in Black.
Yeah.
It's like the whole purpose is so that you just say, oh, it was a man in black, you don't remember my face. It's like, oh, that's good. That's good manipulation.
That is good.
And but we kind of saw him, some of his like insecurities as well when he does meet with the First Elder. Like, he is shaken by it, so he's not just this, you know, totally tough guy cool in every situation. You know, he is afraid of what he's working with. But yeah, I would read more about him if he popped up in another story.
Yeah, they've set up an interesting character there and a sense of hierarchy within the Syndicate, obviously, which would have existed back then. But, you know, that's the thing with this expanded universe. If they do get the chance to tell more stories, and, you know, my instinct is that they will, and I mentioned this on the Agent of Chaos podcast, my instinct is that they would build to show Mulder in Oxford University when he's a bit older, in the mid-80s. And I sense that they potentially would show Scully. They might jump forward a few years and show Scully maybe when she's 19, 20, when she's training for Quantico or, you know, whatever it is. Or she's going into training to be a doctor or whatever and do stories around that. There's every chance we might see these characters again, quite possibly. And I'd hope so, because I think there's potential to develop them along with the backstory of not just Mulder and Scully, but the wider Syndicate world and everything like that, really.
I would read stories about Mulder in Oxford in the 80s in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah. I think it'd be great. I mean, him and Phoebe Green just flirting away while solving crimes. Sign me up. But yeah, I think overall, I think Devil's Advocate really, really does a good job. You know, it taps into a lot of things. It taps into teenage angst. It taps into supernatural elements. You know, it even taps into like the mass hysteria of parents, you know, with the whole thing of the school convinced all the teenagers are on drugs, you know.
Having a drug assembly when I was in high school and sitting there going like, what are they talking about? And I got like same vibe from this of like the students just like kind of rolling their eyes about this.
Yeah, they're all like, oh my God. Because it's that typical reaction, isn't it? That, oh, they must be on drugs. They must be, can't be any other explanation. They must all be on drugs, all these kids. You know, and at the end of the 70s as well, you know, when that culture was a lot more alive and things like that in the youth, it taps into a lot of different interesting things to do with parenthood, to do with families, to do with, like, you know, all this little brew, this concoction, you know. And then, of course, you know, Scully seeing things that, and this is the ultimate point, I think, of the story, that Dana seeing things that are incontrovertibly supernatural, you know, paranormal, like seeing Maisie, the ghost. Like going into that house, the house of Karen, which is really, really creepy sequence, actually, where she's led to this house and she walks into the blackness when she's following Connie, the other dead girl, which really creeped me out, that sequence. It's just, there's lots of little things in this that brew around I don't know about you, it's one of those stories I don't think people would expect a young Dana to go through, and I think that's why it's good.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. When I first was reading through it, I was like, what, this is Scully, she's the scientific one, and then it just kept making sense, like, why she was experiencing this. And I think it pays off really well, both for the individual story that's in this book, and for the character development as a whole.
Yeah, completely, completely. So yeah, we've talked a bit about, we spoiled the whole book.
Sorry.
Let's be honest.
It's all a dream.
Yeah. None of it happens. It's all good. To be fair, if you've listened to this without reading the book, you didn't make the right choice. But if you have and you still you want to go back and read the book, I heartily recommend it. Okay, so you can pick it up anywhere now. It's online. It's on Amazon. It's in all good bookshops. Go and pick up Devil's Advocate. Give it a read. And, you know, the more people buy this and Agent of Chaos, the more chance we'll get sequels. And sequels is what we want. And I know it's what Jonathan Mabry wants. So, yeah, let all go out and buy it, guys. Let's do it. Let's do it. Finally, we're going to talk about your writing, Lauren. We've got to the the most important part of the podcast. And we're going to talk about your... you as a writer and your short story for Secret Agendas Anthology, which came out last autumn, which is... Right, and here we go. Here we go. Tempting to pronounce it now. Sturziga.
I think, like I said, I'm not sure. I'm going with Strizga. Like,
Strizga. I told you I'd get it wrong.
Like Stroy, because I've been watching The Strain, so that's in my head, and it's based on the same myth. The branches off the same myth, so... Hopefully, I'm sure there's somebody out there that can correct us and give us the appropriate pronunciation.
Please do. I always get these things wrong, so it's fine. But yeah, this is, and I genuinely mean this, Lauren. And I said similar to George when he came on for Agent of Chaos because I believed it. It was one of my favorite stories in that anthology. It really, really was. And I think I told you this much like 6 months ago. It was really good short story. So why don't for that, anyone who is unfamiliar, why don't you give us a little bit of a summary as to what Mulder and Scully go through in this one?
So this is a short story set in the first season, really right after Darkness Falls, because like I said, that was my favorite episode. So I had used that as a jumping off point when I was coming up for an idea. And there's been murders in this remote camp, like children's summer camp in the Poconos. So Mulder and Scully get called out there to examine these deaths. And it's their first time that they've been out in the field since the incidents in Darkness Falls. Because that always struck me as odd, because they end Darkness Falls, they're in a really bad place physically. Like, almost all their bodily fluids have been drained. The next episode, they're fine, you know? They're just looking, you know, in the office and outside and doing their thing at full health. So, to me, there was always a gap there. Like, they had to recover, obviously, and then they never talk about Darkness Falls again, so I imagine, like, something else happened. So I wanted to put them back in the woods, though a different type of woods in a different situation, to both play off both of their fears, really. Scully's, for the fact that she was the worse off of the two out of Darkness Falls and was more closer to death, and her needing her to prove herself, prove that she's fine again, and Mulder's guilt that he wasn't able to protect her as he felt he should have been able to. So a lot of the story is... You know, first Mulder doesn't want her to come out in the field with him since they're going out to the woods again. And then when they're there, he's trying to give her all the safe jobs once they're at the camp, which doesn't work out so well. So they kind of explore this mystery of these people, these counselors who have been brutally murdered. And the name Strizga comes from one of the last murdered counselor had painted that word on the wall. And it refers to a Slavic demon that is connected to both like the vampire mythology, but is also more of a monster as well. And they kind of unravel the truth there without spoiling it.
Yeah. Yeah. We don't want to spoil this one. We've already spoiled Devil's Advocate for everybody. Yeah. And it's just a really good monster story. And like you said, it's got a really good, that's one of the things that's really great about these anthology stories, because a lot of the best ones pick a point in the show where there is a gap. And there is a story to tell within that gap. You know, I mean, one of the others in the, I think it's All Along the Scenic Route, which is the Lucy Snyder story in the same book. She picks up right from the end of The List, which is where they drive off after the, in season three, where they drive off after the reincarnation story in the prison. And Mulder can't get his head around it. He knows that he's missing something and he never quite figures it out. And she picks up from that point where they're driving off. So it's great that you pick up from a point here after Darkness Falls, and like you said, they shouldn't, I mean, they really shouldn't have survived it in the first place, really. they were lucky. But it's a nice way, I think, of showing Mulder's protectiveness over Scully already, you know, and this is early on. They haven't been working together that long at this point.
Yeah, I had to go back and like watch, because even by that point in the series, Skinner hasn't even shown up yet in, you know, on screen. He doesn't show up till later that season. So it was really, I had to make sure not to mention him, and to really, I watched the episodes, Darkness Falls, and I watched the few episodes around it too, just to get a sense of what had happened in their relationship up to that point and what hadn't yet, to make sure that I didn't make them too close and not referencing things that hadn't happened yet, but still building off of the relationship they had built up to by that point.
Yeah, and it works. It does work really well. You know, you really get that sense between them that they're building this partnership, and you know, it's all starting to come together. Told under the, you know, as I say, in the prism of this really good monster story. So it's a great little story. It is a great little story. And just so, in case people don't know, how did you get involved in this in the first place? How did you get involved in the book?
This is one of those stories that it's why I tell people now who want to write and who are trying to publish to always take a chance, because you really do never know what's going to happen. Jonathan Mayberry was the editor of this one, and we're both members of the Horror Writers Association. So he had posted on their Facebook page, gosh, this was 3 years ago now, that two writers for these X-Files anthology series had needed to drop out. So he had to fill these spots really quickly. And to do that, he was just opening up to pitches to anyone. And I had seen that. I was like, oh, that would be really cool. You know, to write for the, you know, what, that's my dream, you know. And I thought about it. I was like, no, I'm not going to think of anything good enough. You know, why, you know, he's going to get so many pitches. You know, why even bother to try? And I was not going to submit anything, because he wasn't even asking for a full story, just a pitch. And he needed the pitch of something by like a Wednesday. I forget what it was. And I had woken up the Monday before I was going to work, and I was walking my dog. I thought, you know what? I've got to submit something, because if I don't submit something, I'm probably just going to regret it. Not for, you know, for the rest of my life, as you do. And so since I needed to think of it really quick, because the deadline was coming and I had to get it in, that's why I jumped right to Darkness Falls, because being my favorite episode, that's the episode I rewatch a lot and I've jumped to a lot. So I was like, all right, I'll come up with this pitch. And I had worked at a summer camp and went to a summer camp that I sort of based this on out of love, that played a big part in my life when I was growing up. So I used that location and kind of looked up demons and mythology that hadn't been covered on the show yet, and kind of put the two together. And I whipped something up that morning, typed it up, read it a few times, and I was like, all right, this is as good as I'm going to get it. I'm going to send it off to him. And it was a few months later, I think it was November, because I remember it was around Thanksgiving, and I had just been to the movies, and I walked out of the movie theater, and I saw I had an email from him. I was like, oh, there's my rejection. as you do, as when you get a writer, you get used to it. It's mostly rejection.
Yeah.
And I opened it up, and I was walking out of the theater, and I stopped dead in my tracks. Because it said like, oh, thanks for the pitch, you know, I can't even remember what he wrote. It was just like, yeah, I'd like to use this. Do you want to be a part of the X-Files? And I was like, huh? My mom was like, what's going on? Because she'd gone to the movies with me. I'm like, look, and I couldn't even like say it. I couldn't get the words out. And I just like showed her the email on my phone. And that's it. It was blind luck. And I think somebody had asked him on his Facebook page later about how many pitches he had received, and it was over 600 that he had gotten. And I was just, I'm still amazed that my little story and my little idea is one of the ones that like made it through.
It's pretty great. I mean, it's like I said at the top of the podcast, it must be such a thrill, you know, but it just shows that the story stood out, you know, what you were trying to say really stood out. And that's out of 600. That's no mean feat, Lauren. It's an amazing achievement. Yeah, it's really good. Would you do another one if we had a fourth volume?
Absolutely. Gives me an excuse to watch some more X-Files and to play around with some more ideas. You know, it's pretty exciting when you can spend one night, you know, sitting on your couch, you know, sitting there realizing, and you pause, you go, I'm writing Mulder. You know, it's not just for myself. It's not just for fans as fan fiction, which is also fun. But it's like, this is actually going to be part of the canon.
Because they are all canon. I mean, that is one of the things that Jonathan confirmed on our podcast. Yeah, these are all canon. These all fit in, you know, into the mythology and the lore, which is so cool. So that's fantastic. So what, before we go, what are you working on now then? What's your latest project that's obviously not X-Files related, or is it? Is it connected? Is it similar? Or you tell us.
Nearest project right now is actually my first novel, Abigail Hall, is coming out in the United States for the first time on April 11th in hardback. So it's been out in the UK. It came out in the UK first last year in paperback. That's more of a gothic horror, gothic thriller, not quite X-Files-y. And then I recently, though, finished my second novel at the end of last year, which is, I like to call it a dark X-Files episode, except it's Ooh. Set in Britain in the 1950s.
And oh, has cool.
It has a repressed housewife and a disgraced scientist instead of a Mulder and Scully. Kind of in that vein. And then right now what I'm editing is a murder mystery. Non-supernatural murder mystery, but more like a And Then There Were None style dark humorous type.
Yeah, that's they all sound brilliant. I need to check out your previous book then if it's out in the UK. But yeah, good luck with all those. Yeah, we'll have to keep an eye, you know, and we'll let us know and we'll promote them on our social media and everything like that and give them a bit of, you know, boost the signal as it were. Also, everyone, make sure if you haven't bought the X-Files Secret Agendas yet, get on it. You need to buy that. Okay, read Lauren's work. In print, get that out there, because you know we might get a fourth volume. Jonathan did say it's a possibility if it sells well. It wasn't planned, I don't think, but it's possible. So you know, get on and buy it, guys, if you haven't already, and you'll get some great short stories. So yeah, that's the end of the show then. It's been really great to have you on, Lauren, do this. It's been really lovely to talk to you and to talk about not just Devil's Advocate, but your own work. So thanks for coming on. It's been great.
Oh, thanks. It was awesome to be here.
Well, hopefully we can have you back again. But until you do, where can everyone find you online and find more about your work and everything?
Well, I'm on Twitter at Lauren A. Forry, Forry. And then I have a Facebook page also. So it's facebook.com/LaurenAForryWriter. Don't have my own webpage yet because I am too lazy to set up a full webpage. But you can find me on Twitter, and then you can find me on Facebook there.
I'm going through seemingly endless website changes trying to get the XCast website sorted out. So I feel your pain. It's fine.
Eventually, but for now, yeah, I went the easy route. Twitter and Facebook remade. It's working for now.
Yeah, it does the job. It does the job, definitely. Well, check her out, guys. Check out Lauren's stuff. It's all fantastic, so make sure you get over there and give her a follow and give her a like and all those things. You can do the same for us if you haven't already. We're at the X_cast on Twitter. We have got the XCast Facebook page. You just type in the XCast, and we've got the XCast podcast fan group. We've got loads of members in there now, nearly, you know, plenty of people. So come in, join in on some really great chatter, loads and loads of stuff going on in there. So do check it out. Check us out on iTunes as well. Just type in the XCast. And if you could leave us a review and a like and a rating, that'd be amazing. That will help us hugely. So please do that. And that'd be brilliant. So we'll be back for a brand new episode coming very soon. It will probably be another episode of the show, but we'll see. As we race towards the end of our season 2 coverage. But yeah, we'll be back very soon. And remember, until next time, guys. Trust no one. The XCast is produced and presented by Tony Black, part of the Black Hole Media podcast network. Title music is courtesy of Will A, who you can find on Twitter at I am Will A-Y-E.